Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program. We come your way every Sunday at 7 a.m. and p.m. We come here also Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. And we archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page, for your listening and edification, education, inspiration, and sometimes just fun. We certainly hope that you will avail yourselves of the links to our guests' websites. And today, our link, I suppose we could start a tradition calling it the link of the day, but it changes, of course, with the guest. And in this case, today, it's mindfulnessmeditationinstitute.org. It's also part of the title of the book that my guest Charles Francis has written, Mindfulness Meditation Made Simple, Your Guide to Finding New Inner Peace. The 12 steps, of mindfulness meditation practice, and we certainly hope that this will be beneficial to you. I'm looking for all of the advice I can get, and Charles, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Well, thank you, Richard. Thank you for having me.
This is a subject that, I mean, it's funny how these kinds of things take on a life of their own. And I'm going to use case in point, yoga, which this is not, although I suppose it could be a form thereof. When these types of concepts are brought into mainstream, there is a huge amount of resistance, especially in America, because of the alleged source, where this comes from. Yoga in this country has just boomed, but there are still pockets in this country that, especially in the school systems, that resist it because it's quote-unquote Middle Eastern. It's Indian. It's, well, right. It's not American. We didn't invent it. It didn't come from Christianity. And yet, if you did a little research, you'd find out that the type of yoga, depending upon what you're searching for, you can find it within the annals of Christendom. Well, meditation even more so, because there's one individual I think of from the New Testament, Mary, the mother of Jesus, who, when he was doing all of the things that he did, there's a passage in there that refers to her, and she pondered these things in her heart as a form of meditation. People tend to do that with, for example, and I'm focusing on these kinds of things because I want to bring this around, the rosary, for example. It's a meditation. Various forms of solitude, if you will, contemplative life. We hear about the monastic order, you know, and the monks and cloistered off on a hillside or down in a valley away from society. I personally think, Charles, that it's those people who are doing that kind of work, those who are praying for and meditating on, you know, peace and harmony and so forth, they're the glue that's holding this planet together. And if they ever stopped, we'd be in serious trouble.
We sure would.
But meditation has an interesting challenge before it. And that's what I want to get into, because you talk about mindfulness. Talking about the mind, it's the one area they say you've got to quiet the mind. You've got to quiet the monkey mind. You've got to shut down those thoughts and on and on and on. And I suspect that's not quite what you're talking about here when it comes to mindfulness meditation.
Well, actually, that's part of it, but there's more to mindfulness meditation than just quieting the mind. Because, first of all, our mind gets very agitated through all our daily activities. We're constantly bombarded with stimulation. And all that does is just accelerate our mind and the thoughts. And we never really get our mind a chance to rest. And it's hard to get all that rest at night when we sleep. So part of it is quieting the mind, but there's more to it with mindfulness meditation.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the way I explain mindfulness meditation, it's like a training of the mind. Just as an athlete trains his body, a meditator trains his mind. So by quieting the mind, we're able to become more focused, We can direct our attention more clearly without being distracted so easily. And that has important implications for all areas of our lives, not just our personal lives, but also our work, our career, anything we want to do. If we have a more calm and focused mind, then we're going to be more effective at it. And I think that's why it's becoming more accepted, more mainstream, so to speak, because businesses are starting to see the value of this. It's giving them a competitive advantage in their industries. If their employees are more focused, if they're more creative, which mindfulness meditation helps them be, if their memory improves, all these things help them in their job. So that's part of the reason why it's becoming so accepted. And go ahead.
Well, you used two groups of people I wanted to dovetail off of, athletes and, of course, the business world. Mm-hmm. Now, athletes have a particular goal in mind when they are training their bodies to perform the various athletic endeavors that they've undertaken. And so that begs the question that anybody who has contemplated but not dove in to meditation is, what is the purpose? What's the end game of meditation?
Well, we'd have to go back to the Buddhist roots of it. The Buddha's original intention was to help us find freedom from suffering. And that, and our suffering stems a lot from our misunderstanding of the way things are. So we make bad decisions. It's like making a business decision without much information. We're not going to make good decisions. So it's the same thing with our personal lives. And a lot of times our emotions are triggered by misunderstandings, you know, things that we see as hurting us personally when they're not necessarily intended to us personally. So really the goal, the ultimate goal is to find freedom from suffering. I mean, that's why, you know, many of us chase material things or relationships or things outside of us, because we want them to make us happy. Our ultimate goal is to be happy. But in Buddhism, it's more than just happiness. It's more inner peace. So their approach is, instead of searching outside of ourselves for things that stimulate pleasant emotions, which are short-lived, the Buddhist approach is to eliminate the sources of our suffering. And one of those is mental agitation, which leads to stress and anxiety and a whole host of physical ailments. And it leads to mental and emotional disorders. So by eliminating all these sources of suffering, we become more at peace. And that's what freedom of suffering is. So that's really the ultimate goal of meditation.
And there would be those who, of course, are going to probably also speculate or postulate, if you will, that there are a lot of different goals, if you will, for meditating. But the other aspect is the business community, and I become slightly skeptical of the motives of business when taking on some of these spiritual practices, because it seems like initially their whole goal is, when they hear of the results of individuals, is, ooh, right, then this could make my company more profitable. And it's kind of like missing the boat, so to speak, when it comes to these practices, that the purpose of many of these practices isn't to make you wealthier necessarily. You may end up becoming more wealthy by clearing the mind and settling things and you know, not dealing with the issues regarding suffering in our lives. And of course, I, growing up, born and raised Catholic, I know a little bit about suffering.
Yeah.
But I think that maybe the universe has it well in hand this is the process. And I have to wonder too, if businesses maybe initially they may say, hey, we see some profitable attributes to this practice. Let's incorporate this in our business. But as they get into it, they begin to realize, ooh, maybe there is more to life than profit.
Yeah. Well,
I'm not saying profit's wrong, but I'm just, you know.
Right. Yeah, well, that is a criticism for businesses taking on the practice. But, you know, the way I see it is, you know, before we get involved in a spiritual practice, you know, our motives, you know, they're not entirely pure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because, you know, we need spiritual, you know, some spiritual growth. So until we, you know, gain some enlightenment, you know, through our spiritual practice, our motives aren't going to be the purest in the world. But at least you're getting them to the table. You're getting them to begin a practice so they can start to see things from a much broader perspective. Now, when businesses engage in mindfulness meditations, you know, sure, like you said, they want to increase their profits. They're looking for anything that will help them in that goal. But when they start to see that their employees are happier, they're under less stress, they're part of a bigger community, that they affect the broader communities. So that's part of the spiritual awakening that we achieve through a mindfulness meditation practice, is that we see our connection to the rest of the world, and we stop identifying so much with our individual self and more with a broader community. And we start participating in that. We start to see how our actions affect, have a long, far-reaching effect in our community and in time as well. So, you know, I don't criticize people's motives for taking on a practice. You know, some people do it to gain relationships. Some people do it for monetary reasons. Whatever they are, the important thing is that you begin to practice, and from there you'll start to see things differently.
It's starting to see the big picture, I think, is a very important aspect to all of this. Now, when you say that, you know, we start these practices not for the most altruistic of motives, and I think that you know, I am dealing with, you know, hypertension, high blood pressure, like who isn't anymore these days?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the one thing that I keep being told is, you need to meditate. You need to meditate. And I've been doing these interviews for, you know, 30 plus years. You'd think, oh man, this guy must be meditating, you know, 5-10 hours a day and just be, must be doing great. No. So, because I guess I find it so difficult to find the time to meditate. Now, because this is being suggested by a lot of good friends, as well as my wife, to spend time meditating, I'm sitting here going, okay, to prolong my life, to preserve my health, rather self-centered motives on the one hand, you know, I'm trying to find a form. I'm trying to find a structure, you know, and maybe mindfulness meditation is the direction that I need to go. Where do you suggest people start, especially someone like myself, who is he hears and he knows internally, even from that still small voice that's beckoning, yes, meditate. Listen to those people. They're right. You need to do this. Where do I start?
Yeah, well, that's exactly why I wrote the book, because people very often, you know, they hear about meditation and how good it's going to be for them, but they find it hard getting traction on their practice. So I address all these issues. First of all, getting started, and second, staying committed.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first things that I suggest to people in the introduction of the book is to write a goal statement, because as you probably heard, you know, most successful people, when they want to accomplish something, they set goals for themselves. And by setting goals, we're making a commitment to ourselves that we're going to follow through on this. And it's hard for us to go back on our word, you know, once we make that commitment. There's a psychological quirk in our mind that we don't want to look inconsistent. And you saw that in the presidential election a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, about candidates appearing inconsistent. So we have people write a goal statement, you know, set modest goals for yourself, achievable goals. You know, don't, you know, say I'm going to meditate an hour every day for the next 6 months, because, you know, once we go a couple days without following through on that goal, we're going to quit. We're going to get discouraged. So we set goals that are achievable, and that will help us stay committed. So say, for example, commit to meditating like 15 minutes every other day. Now, how hard is it to find 15 minutes every other day?
Well, that's, I don't know. I don't know. Well, my schedule is so full.
That's actually another aspect that we address. And when we're dealing with a racing mind, is part of it is having too many commitments. So what I ask people to do in the book, we have exercise at the end of each chapter to guide you through this, is to make a list of your commitments by order of priority and see which ones are really important. For example, of course, you know, we have a family, you know, we have a job, you know, we have responsibilities. We can't give up those. But certain things at the bottom, you know, that are of low priority, we can maybe give them up in order to make just a few minutes a week for a little bit of meditation, for more personal time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of us, you know, we have so many commitments to other people, but we don't have many commitments to ourselves as an individual.
Yeah.
We don't have commitments to taking care of ourselves, like, say, for example, some exercise or some quiet time just to sit and reflect and kind of sort out some of the things that are going on in our lives. So by making this list, you know, we can see it clearer. We can see it on black and white paper, you know, what's important to us.
It's an interesting juxtaposition we find ourselves in, because on the one hand, as you've very well stated, you know, we're doing all of these other things for other people, your job, your family, you know, whatever other outside activities that you have. But then the other side of it is, I need to do this for in my case, for example, my health, or a business for our profit, or, you know, again, whatever those self-centered motives are. And it's like, oh, wait a minute. On the one hand, you've got out there, and on the other hand, you have in here. And it seems to me like, in spite of the fact that that sort of kind of sounds balanced, it's really out of whack. And it's obvious because, well, just look around. I mean, in my case, I joined, a few years ago, I joined that wonderful little club of those who have high blood pressure, my mother included. Now, she says it's hereditary. Okay. So I'm curious about that, Charles. If something is, there's a condition that they say, oh, you know, this meditation is going to help that condition. But if it's hereditary, how do you break that, shall we say, that DNA code? How do you rewrite it so that, not necessarily so you don't pass it on, but so that you rewrite it for yourself at least?
Yeah. Well, a lot of things that they say are hereditary, it's more of a predisposition. What that means is that we're more likely to, say, for example, be obese if that's hereditary.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean that we're powerless over it. It doesn't mean that we can't do something about it and to minimize that hereditary predisposition. So I suspect that with high blood pressure and heart disease and cancers, you know, though it may run in our families, we can do things to minimize the risk, because part of why we acquire or we develop these conditions is because of environmental factors. Sure, it's in our family, it's in our genes, but it doesn't mean that we can't do something about it. So with, for example, high blood pressure, which often comes from stress, very often we can do a lot about it. And also, one thing to keep in mind is some conditions, they may seem hereditary because we've seen it all in our families. They aren't necessarily physically hereditary. It's more of a behavior pattern that's been passed down from generation to generation. In other words, if we grew up around high-strung parents, chances are our children are going to be high-strung because, you know, we're stimulating their mind, we're agitating their mind, and it's just simply, you know, because we're agitated. So then they grow up thinking that's normal. So then they pass it on to their children. So a lot of things that we say are hereditary may not be entirely hereditary. It's more a matter of a behavior that's passed on from generation to generation that's creating these conditions.
It's interesting that you put it that way, because I've often kind of pondered myself this aspect of a baby being born and the relatives circle around and they start pointing out all the similarities. Oh, Uncle Bill's nose and Aunt Fran's forehead and on and on. And then as the child grows and exhibits certain personality traits, oh my goodness, he has Uncle Bill's anger or his sister's laugh or whatever, his mother's, what have you, and so on and so forth. And I thought, well, if those traits can be passed on, then why can't other attributes of the human being be passed on too, both the physical, the mental, the emotional, and for that matter, even the spiritual attributes that doesn't predispose them to being unique individuals, but they're unique in the sense that they have an incredible combination of all of these attributes that makes them who they are.
Right. Yeah, so, you know, I always challenge I shouldn't say outwardly challenge people when they say that something is in their family is hereditary. You know, sure, that some truly are, but behavior patterns, I'm very skeptical about behavior patterns and conditions that stem from behavior patterns, because a lot of them are really environmental factors.
Hmm.
So it's really hard to scientifically to prove that something is hereditary. Unless it's like a physical condition, like say colon cancer, that's probably is hereditary, but you're more predisposed.
Right.
But still, even if it is, you can still do a lot to minimize the risk.
Hmm. It reminds me of that story you hear. I'm sure you've heard this. My wife and I, anytime we hear something like this, we both clue in on it and we say Hamshanks. And the reason is because it's the story of the family that has gathered for, say, Thanksgiving dinner. And in the kitchen, they're preparing the ham. And the grandmother is, she's got the big old piece of ham, and she slices off the ends. She puts it in the pan. She puts it in the oven, and away it goes. Mm-hmm. And one of the kids observes this and asks the question of his mother, Why do we cut the ends of the ham off before we put it in the pans? Well, that's just the way we do it. It's the way we've always done it. So finally, they get to the grandmother and ask her that very question. She says, because that's the only way it'll fit in the pan. Okay? That's the only, it's like, okay, you could get a bigger pan, but we choose to chop off the ends to fit it in the pan. And so it's like sometimes we take on those hereditary, let's put it this way. My mother has told me that high blood pressure runs in the family. All right. I can choose whether I want to take on that hereditary mindset or not.
Right.
Doesn't mean I won't get it. Doesn't mean I will get it. But at least if I don't take it on, my mind isn't going in that direction to where I'm sort of drawing it to myself. And I think that's kind of what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, if we examine some of our behaviors and see if they're contributing to that high blood pressure,
mm-hmm.
then we can change that behavior. And that's one of the great things about mindfulness meditation is it helps us see these causal connections. We become more in tune with our bodies and our minds and see how our behavior is affecting us both physically, mentally, and emotionally. It helps us just see the whole world from a much broader perspective, and we begin to understand things. We begin to understand relationships. Understanding relationships was something that I thought I was going to go to my grave never understanding. But, you know, when you examine yourself very closely, you know, you start to see, for example, in my case, I start to see what my motives were for behaving the same way each time in certain interactions, in certain relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that, keeping in mind that other people behave very similarly because they're human beings also. So we all have very similar motives. We have similar needs, similar wants. So we all want to be loved. We all want attention. We all want to feel like we're part of. So we have these behavior patterns. And we don't really see them unless we develop a little more mental clarity. And that's where the mindfulness meditation helps us tremendously. We begin to see what our motives are for behaving the way we do, and we can also see that in other people and realize that they're not that much different than us.
When we come back from our break, I want to dive into some of these steps, if we can, and discuss some other areas as well. We're talking with Charles Francis. He is the author of The Mindfulness Meditation Made Simple. We hope you'll stay with us. This is Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Stay with us. Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. We're talking about mindfulness meditation made simple with Charles Francis. And Charles, before we went to break, you said something really interesting about relationships in terms of your understanding. And I know that as we go through these 12 steps, which I find an interesting similarity, as I'm sure you may be were very much aware as you were writing it, and that is the sort of the 12 steps of AA kind of thing. But it's I think the first step that I've, because you mentioned this early on in the program, talking about suffering, and personal freedom begins with understanding your suffering. And I made the little joke about, you know, being raised Catholic and, you know, I know about suffering, but what do you mean by that, suffering?
Well, it mainly refers to mental and emotional anguish. We all know what it feels like when we break up with somebody that we care about or we lose a loved one. Those are obvious cases of suffering, and where we feel that pain for some extended period of time. But also there's more subtle levels of suffering. For example, when we're stuck in traffic, and the traffic's not moving, you know, we start to get anxious. We start to get frustrated because we're not able to accomplish what we want or get the things that we want that we think are going to make us happy. So these this is like an undercurrent of suffering that's going on in our lives that we're not fully aware of. And we don't really see that very often until it's gone. It's kind of like the sound of the refrigerator. I use that analogy, is that we don't really know that the refrigerator is running until it stops, because the silence is almost deafening. So when we look deeper at the nature of suffering, we start to see that very small things can create a little bit of suffering in us, and keep us. They all keep us from being at peace. So until we start to first see them, you know, we can't address them. So once we see them, we can start to do something about them. And the more we address all these issues that are creating our suffering, the more at peace we'll be.
I think that this whole aspect of suffering, some have stated that if we didn't have the suffering, we wouldn't know the joy. And I sometimes wonder if that's really, I mean, it's like we're in a dualistic world. So in order to really comprehend the pluses, as we like to mm-hmm. label them, we have to experience the minuses. And I don't know, I may be wrong, but I'm feeling that just not, we don't have to do that. It seems to me like meditation, there is no dualistic aspect to meditation. Either you do it or you don't, you know?
Well, with suffering, one of the Four Noble Truths in Buddhism is acknowledging the existence of suffering, which basically says that suffering is part of everyday life.
Okay.
It's part of being human. So we can use it either for us or we can let it work against us.
Okay.
In my life, since I was very young, I started my spiritual path when I was in my early 20s. I decided to make it work for me, to motivate me into finding a way out of it. And I sometimes, tell people that, being completely content, I'm not sure if that's the best condition, because if we're completely content, then where's the motivation to keep improving ourselves? So, fortunately, life, is filled with suffering. There's always a new form of suffering that we can encounter. So there's always enough motivation to help keep us going. But, yeah, you're right. Sometimes, we need a little bit of suffering to help us see that there is a way out, and that to motivate us to keep moving forward.
Mm. I had the distinct pleasure of spending some time in a place that I absolutely thoroughly enjoy being, and it's one of the reasons that I moved here to the Central Coast, was to be down by the water, down by the ocean, as it's lapping up on the rocks of a particular stretch of the beach here. And I have to say that it was in spite of the fact that there were more people there than I probably would have liked, it was still an incredible experience for me. And I keep thinking, okay, I've got to get back there. I've got to get back, and it's not far. I don't have, it's not like I have to travel a great distance because it's within the city limits. But I know that a lot of people don't really have these kinds of places to go physically. I mean, it would be nice. And I used to struggle with that whole aspect of, if I could just find that place that nobody else could find, that I could go, And then I realized that if I could find it, so could everybody else. Mm-hmm. And then I realized, I was watching this, I forget which movie it was, but they were talking about meditation, and it hit me. I know where that place is now. but it's not out here.
Right.
And we can actually create any environment we want in that inner space.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be that contemplative place. And we can change it. We can change it and have several different places that we really love being. So I think that location can, you know, can be certainly helpful, but it is certainly not a prerequisite, because we can set that up for ourselves. One of the other aspects that you talk about here in the steps has to do with, you talk about powerful tools to transform and design, deepen your relationships. You dove into that a little bit. I'm finding too that as I'm getting older, and I don't know if this is your experience or not, Charles, but even though I have always felt that relationships were extremely important in my life, even at an early age, and I began my search, my, if you will, spiritual quest at the age of 17, but I've always felt that every relationship that comes along, and no matter how brief or expansive, makes me more of who I am. It changes me. It makes me a different person just from that experience. I grow from that. But that just the relating with no agenda. Whereas, I'm going to go back to the business world. Whereas in the business world, most of your relationships are for business, to drum up more business, to generate more revenue, and so on and so forth. That's why I've always had trouble with sales. I was always told that when you're dealing with sales, what you want to do is you want to develop a relationship. Yeah, but the motive always seemed to me so disingenuous. I really didn't. I don't care about this person. I care about his wallet. So
yeah,
that's one of the reasons why I've always enjoyed those connections, such as with you here on this program. We don't have an agenda here. I mean, yeah, we are certainly talking about mindfulness meditation, but that's the whole point, is to share this with other people, to glean and so forth. There's always an exchange that I do get, but it's not hidden. It's right out there in the open. We acknowledge that.
Yeah. Well, as part of being human is we have motives that are very instinctual. Need for attention, need for recognition, need for emotional gratification, and they're impossible to get away from unless we start identifying with something other than our ego. Because our ego is the one that is always searching for meaning in our lives. It always is searching for something to validate its existence. And until we transcend that, we're always going to be searching for things to please the ego. But when we start to see things or develop mindfulness through the practice, which mindfulness is just basically awareness of the world and ourselves, when we start to develop that, then we start to identify less with our own individual ego and start to see how we're connected with the rest of the world. And then we'll see that our helping other people, you know, we're helping ourselves as well. And we start to have more compassion for other people, and we just start to see the less of a need for personal gratification. And then we start moving more toward just finding inner peace instead of some kind of emotional gratification.
I'm curious as to your immediate relationships, family and so forth, and their response to this. I mean, you said you started your spiritual search at the age of, what was it, 21, 22?
23.
23? So you've been at it a while. And so the people around you, family, you know, and so forth, they're very much aware of this. Was this much of a surprise to them as far as your coming to this awareness of the importance of the need for meditation in one's life, in your life in particular. And then all of a sudden you've written this book, and now it's like, and I want to share this with the rest of the world kind of thing.
Well, keep in mind that this was all, my spiritual development was all a very gradual process over the span of, I'm not going to give away my age here, about 30 years.
Okay.
So it was basically, you know, I was growing up, so to speak, becoming a more mature person, which, you know, you kind of expect somebody to do as they get older.
Well, they hope.
Yeah, but unfortunately with some people it doesn't happen. You know, that, and that's really sad because, you know, some people get very caught up in their behavior patterns and this emotional gratification at the expense of other people. And they just create a lot of suffering for them and the people around them. So, you know, as far as relationships are concerned, you know, keep in mind that this is the mindfulness meditation practice, for the most part, addresses the way we deal with relationships, the way we deal with other people, how we react to their behavior or their words and so forth. It doesn't fix them. So although we can behave in a different way that will not trigger unwholesome behavior in other people, it doesn't necessarily change them at a fundamental level. It can have substantial impact, especially with children, but it won't necessarily fix the other person. Mm. Put it that way. It's up to them to engage in a spiritual practice and for them to grow emotionally and mentally.
Interesting.
So you know, with my family, you know, some of them have received it well, and some of them, you know, they don't care a whole lot.
Well, I've learned over the years that there have been some myths that we have been taught that I've finally discovered they aren't true. One of them is you're told over and over again that you can't change other people. And some would say, well, but that's true. You can't. And I disagree. Just by virtue of what you have said, you have changed other people. Now, you can't control how you change them. That's the proviso. But you change, when you change, they change, because they then have to, they are going to react to your changes in whatever way they're going to. I mean, it's like you just said, some have embraced it, they liked it, and others say, no, stay, keep away, you know, that's kryptonite. I don't, I want no part of this. You know, and so when we talk about changing the world, in a manner of speaking, which, you know, you kind of allude to in terms of, you know, even in one of your steps here, you know, about living a mindful life, if, for example, transforming your life in the world, again, through that mindful living. Well, you know, a lot of people used to say that, oh, if you think about trying to change the world, that's just too monumental. It's too big.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that that's what we do every time we change, every time we transform our lives, and we're constantly doing that when we're aware of what's going on.
Oh, yeah. We impact the world whether we want to or not.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be the positive or negative. So we have to make the decision, how do we want to impact the world? And how can we go about it impacting it in a more direct and more effective manner? And that's where mindfulness meditation really helps, because we start to see the far-reaching implications of our actions. And this is something that business leaders can really benefit from, and, you know, not just financially, but also helping make the world a better place, because, let's face it, you know, whether business leaders or political leaders, they have significant influence over what happens in the world. And if they can see from a much broader perspective their interconnection with the world and how they can impact the world either positively or negatively, you know, then they can make better decisions. So, you know, leaders become more than just a leader. They become visionaries. And, you know, we have, you know, very few true visionaries in our world that can really see the long-term implications of their actions. And I think this is one thing that's going to really benefit humanity through mindfulness meditation, is that we're going to create more visionaries, people who can impact the world on a greater scale. And if we keep training ourselves, if we keep developing our mindfulness, then we all can become visionaries. You know, you don't have to be somebody in a high position. You know, any of us can impact the world in a great way if we see the consequences of our actions. So, you know, mindfulness meditation has applications in all areas of life, you know, not just our personal lives, but also, you know, the world in general. So we can contribute quite a bit to bring about world peace instead of just letting the world disintegrate. Mm. We're all participants, as Thich Nhat Hanh says. You know, we're all part of this world. We all make a contribution. Now, it's our decision is, what kind of contribution do we want to make? Do we want it to be a positive or negative?
I have to wonder sometimes how many of the world leaders actually spend time meditating and how the general public would perceive them if they knew, if they haven't already, say, said to that effect, yes, I meditate. I mean, what do you think the response to the American people would be if they found out Barack Obama or Joe Biden or any of the members? Facetiously, I say, I don't think any of the members of Congress meditate.
Actually, they do.
Really?
Congressman Ryan, he's a big proponent of mindfulness meditation.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why, but I'm surprised that regardless of party, that a politician would care.
Actually, he's recruited a few other congressmen to join him in meditation.
Wow. That's quite profound, actually.
Yeah, and he's every opportunity he gets, he tries to encourage people to take on the practice. So it's becoming much more accepted, and you know, look at it this way, instead of how the American public is going to react, whether they're going to accept it or not, if Barack Obama were to engage in meditation, he would set an example. He wouldn't set an example for other people to follow. Instead of, you know, him succumbing to the pressure of the American public. So, you know, leaders can do quite a bit to help promote the practice by setting an example of what the practice can do and how we can help, how it helps us make better decisions in the world. So I think, you know, now mindfulness meditation is really starting to get some traction here in the West, and you know, it isn't something that I don't think it's a fad. At least not mindfulness meditation from its more secular form. You know, sure, you know, it has its roots in Buddhism, but you know what mindfulness meditation teachers are trying to do today is they're trying to extract any religious component or any religious affiliation to Buddhism and just try and present it as a practice.
Mm-hmm.
And not a religion. And that's, I think, one of the main reasons why it's really beginning to catch on, because the American public sees this as compatible with Western values. We We all want to have better relationships. We all want to calm our emotions. You know, we want to calm our mind. We want to improve our memory. We want to improve our ability to think, because all these have practical benefits to our everyday lives. So I think the world leaders, can have significant impact in helping to promote the practice. And really, any of us, like I was saying before, any of us can. I mean, you know, a few years ago, you know, I was nobody. You know, nobody heard of Charles Francis and his meditation practice. But, you know, I start to wake up and I start to realize that I have a skill that other people can benefit significantly from. And it became my duty to share this with others. You know, because if I just go to my grave just with the practice just benefiting me personally, you know, what good is that? You know, I obviously wouldn't have awakened spiritually, because I wouldn't have seen my connection with the rest of the world. So that's why in my book I talk a lot about teaching others and helping others learn the practice. Because that's part of what we see when we develop mindfulness. We see our interconnection with the rest of humanity, and we develop compassion for them. So we want to help them ease their suffering. So, you know, it's important for us, all of us, to become leaders. And we can do that. You know, I used to think of myself as a follower. You know, I was never really going to do anything of any consequence in this world. You know, just going to go about living my own life, you know, my own happy life, and that was it. But, you know, I started to realize, well, I'm not really helping humanity a whole lot. And, you know, with what I see now, you know, it's important for me to do that.
I'd even say, too, that through the process and the practice, we can also begin to change our perspectives, our views on the various things that we view in this world. I could even take a case in point, even how we view politicians. Oh, really? They meditate? Are you kidding me? To how wonderful. That's fantastic. I'm glad to hear that they're doing that. We're talking with Charles Francis. He's the author of Mindfulness Meditation Made Simple, Your Guide to Finding True Inner Peace. It's the 12 steps of the mindfulness meditation practice that are contained within the pages, within the covers, if you will, between the covers. The website is Mindfulness Meditation Institute. Is there a physical institute, or is this something that's internet-based and people can go and gather information in that fashion?
Well, right now it's mostly online, but we do hold workshops and retreats and do consultations for organizations. But, you know, one thing I encourage people to do is to start their own group, and they can download from our website a free group starter kit, because we developed actually a network throughout the world of loosely affiliated groups that are following these 12 steps. And the reason we formatted 12 steps was to make it a lot easier for people to begin the practice and stay committed to it. Because like you were saying in the beginning, you know, it's hard for us to get started.
Would you say that these 12 steps are the way that you've broken them down into 12, as say opposed to 6, is the fact that they're small steps, and they just you're just taking them through it, going through sort of a slow progression. There's no rush here, but also, you know, we're not trying to cram a lot into one step kind of thing.
Exactly. Well, the way I format it is the first few steps, you know, teaches some basic principles, like, say, of suffering and the nature of suffering, how we overcome it. Then I talk about some of the tools that we use to develop mindfulness. And then I talk about, for example, eliminate the sources of our mental agitation, and then how to develop our our meditation sessions. So it's like baby steps into the practice. And then in the middle steps, you know, you learn tools that will help you enhance your practice. Because the whole mindfulness meditation practice is a little more than just meditating. You know, it's what we do with it afterwards, in addition to learning how the things that get in the way of our practice. And that's significant, because a lot of our behaviors are actually working against us. So it's kind of like trying to fill a leaky bucket. You know, we keep meditating, but then on the other hand, we're overstimulating our minds with either too many activities or a lot of background noise, or, you know, engaging too many mobile devices. So the steps are designed to just like walk you through the whole practice. And in the book, at the end of each chapter, I have exercises that people can do to implement the techniques or to learn the principles a little better. So it just really makes it a lot easier for people to take on the practice and to stay committed, because this is a format that they can follow at their own pace.
Before we wrap this program up, first of all, I want to thank you so much for sharing this hour with us. This has been great. I've really enjoyed this, and encourage folks to check out mindfulnessmeditationinstitute.org and the book of basically the same thing, same name, Mindfulness Meditation Made Simple. And again, the author is Charles Francis, and we are, again, very grateful for your taking the time to share this with us. But before we wrap up, let me ask you, who is Charles A. Francis?
That was a good question. I'm still trying to figure that out myself. It's a continuous journey of self-exploration. I mean that's more from an existential perspective, but you know, I have a background, you know, in the business world and in politics, as we were talking about before. So I've been involved in various aspects of society, and it's helped me develop a much broader perspective of the challenges that all these actors have to deal with. So I'm still growing, and I'm still trying to find out who Charles is, and mindfulness meditation practice is what's helping me do that.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
What I'd like to do is see a fellowship develop from these 12 steps, you know, very much like the other 12-step programs like Alcoholics Anonymous and so forth. And just for it to grow on its own, because those organizations have done tremendously, have done a lot of good in helping people recover from alcoholism and addiction and so forth. And I think these 12 steps, the mindfulness meditation practice, can also help take their spirituality to another level, to a deeper realization of who they are and their relationship to the rest of the world. And I think it can have significant impact in helping solve a lot of the common ailments we have in society.
And finally, who inspires you?
Who inspires me? Actually, it's most of the people I meet. You know, whenever I see people, you know, who are on their spiritual journey and who are excited about it and who are learning about themselves, that just gives me a tremendous amount of joy, and it inspires me to keep working. You know, I do volunteer work at a homeless shelter a couple times a week, and, you know, part of it is also a treatment center for alcoholism and addiction. And when I see those guys enthusiastic about making their lives better, how to improve themselves, you know, it just really inspires me to keep working at this.
Well, we thank you for the work that you have done on this particular work, and that being the Mindfulness Meditation Made Simple book. Again, it is your guide to finding true inner peace. It is the 12 steps of the mindfulness meditation practice. We encourage you to pick it up. The author is, again, Charles A. Francis, who has been my guest here on the program. Again, Charles, thank you so much for the time today.
Well, thank you, Richard. It's been my pleasure to share with you.
I'm Richard Dugan. Thank you so much for joining us here on the program. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.